The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Cases of the coronavirus are approaching 1.5 million, and the death toll has climbed to nearly 87,000 people in this country.
And today the House is set to vote on a new $3 trillion relief bill. This bill would include a second round of stimulus checks for many Americans, but President Trump has already said the bill is dead on arrival.
All right, the Moneyball numbers, 2,981,000 on initial jobless claims. And do remember, the historic week we all would like to forget was the 27th of March, where it was 6,867,000. So basically, we're looking at half speed, which is still way too much.
The economic fallout of the pandemic has hit women disproportionately hard. CNBC contributor Joanne Lippman writing today that the pandemic may cause a she session, and that could impact diversity in the workplace for years to come. This is not just a theory. This is borne out by the numbers. Women were 55% of the people who were laid off since this all began, right?
That's right. And it's not only women as a whole. If you look at the different groups of workers and the different age cohorts, there's an especially huge differential between men and women at the youngest ages, from 20 to 24, at the older ages, over 50, women of color. Also, it's a huge issue. And a big piece of it is that women are overrepresented in the industries that have been hit the hardest. And we're talking about things like hospitality and travel and restaurants and childcare.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Industrial production in the U.S. plunges by 11.2% in April, while unemployment claims rise to 36.5 million in the latest reporting week. Meanwhile, retail sales fell by 16.4%, the biggest drop on record, as major indexes go into corrective mode, losing 1.4% for the week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to the Financial Sense News Hour. Bullseye Craig Johnson joins me this week. He believes the S&P 500 will remain in corrective consolidation, ranging between 2,800 and 3,000 for much of the summer. But he's still sticking to his year-end target of 3,600. You're going to want to hear about his top three sectors to own in this market. Later on in the program, Ralph McLaughlin joins me as we look at the real estate market, which is on temporary pause, according to Ralph. But it still looks good as millennials move into their peak earning years. And Chris Poplavin, Chris Sheridan will bring you another edition of Smart Macro. But let's first find out what drove the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. Some profit-taking and some awareness that the U.S. stock market may have rallied too far and too fast set in for the early half of the week. At one point by Thursday, the S&P 500 had declined by 6.1% from its intraday high only a couple of days before. So let's review some of the comments that led the market down and what caused the market to rally at the end of the week. Director Fauci, talking about infectious diseases, who's been a spokesperson about the coronavirus, had said at a Senate committee hearing that opening economies up too soon runs a risk of reaccelerating the wave of coronavirus infections. At the time of his comments, there was an LA Times story same day commenting on the likelihood that LA County's stay-at-home order would be in place through July. So both of these stories hit the reopening trade pretty hard. The reopening of the U.S. economy trade, as it was, which has been lifting stocks for some time over the past few weeks. On Wednesday, Fed Chair Powell said that the future is uncertain with significant downside risks still, which he used to reinforce the call to action by the Fed to do whatever it takes to support the economy. So he also continued to support the need for more fiscal support as well, but you know, we'll talk about that later. The final two comments that reaffirmed the concerns by investors over stock valuations, which led to the correction this week, was from Stanley Druckenmiller, who said that risk-reward ratio for stocks is as bad as he's ever seen it in his career. And then Appaloosa Management's David Tepper confirmed those thoughts on a CNBC interview, saying only in 1999 was the market ever more overvalued. So our Financial Sense team has been of the same mind these past few podcasts, stating the market has rallied in a V fashion due to the stimulus and reopening hopes, but because not every state is the same, not every business has the same risks to infection, that we are likely to not going to reopen all at the same time, nor are consumers ready to go back to their vacationing and spending ways immediately. So a V-like economic recovery really is not in the cards. My brother, Chris Poplava, wrote a great piece to our clients about this, which was titled, Where is the L-U-V, the love? Talking about all of the letters the industry has used in the past to label the shape of economic recoveries can take. We'll be adjusting it for the public consumption and should get it out to everybody next week. Okay, so those were the catalysts that led to the mini correction of 6.1%, that dip. Let's talk about what led the rebound, which started on Thursday. We've seen some buy the dip action in the market in April a couple of times, one specifically where the S&P had corrected 5%. We do know that there's plenty of cash that's sitting on the sidelines, more in fact than we've ever seen in money market funds, and more than was at the peak in the financial crisis of 2008 to 2009. So that has led dips so far to be shallow. We haven't seen the catalyst enough to really drive bearish sentiment to bring that to bear on the market. So what we did see was action that was assisted by comments from the White House. They're open to a fourth stimulus bill, just not the $3 trillion bill the House has put together this week and is voting on Friday. Most Republicans, according to CNN, have said this bill is dead on arrival in the Senate. Most other bills that have passed have all been bipartisan and have passed with cooperation. So it was unfortunate to see that right now there's a slant to what's going on in Congress. But investors responded to the comments by Trump that, again, they're open to something else, just not the current bill that's being voted on this week. Two more mini catalysts assisted in the rally, which includes an IEA report suggesting demand for oil has been stronger than expected. And that led to an 8.3% gain on West Texas Intermediate crude on Thursday and led to further rally on Friday. And that was looked as a positive sign. And an interesting tweet from a Fox Business correspondent Thursday over speculation Wells Fargo could buy Goldman Sachs to compete against JP Morgan led banks to a rally very strongly that they led the advance on Thursday. And this has been an area that has been languishing and not really participating in the rally and a bit of a concern by many technicians. So I did want to mention that a White House move to block shipments of semiconductors to Huawei and China discussing retaliation with technology and semiconductor groups receiving the brunt of the profit taking on Friday did hit the market and led to some early weakness, but that seemed to fade away as many Chinese and U.S. spokespersons commented in tensions, including Larry Kudlow, that the plan is to continue to foster better trade. So that's pretty much it for this week. You know, we've got a stock market that's trading in between two very key moving averages. The S&P is below the 200-day average. That's right around 3,000. And still above the 50-day moving average, which is right around 2712 to 2700, maybe. So we're in this very tight range. It's going to be interesting to see which one of those levels breaks. Is it the bears controlling and taking the market below the 50-day moving average? Or is the bulls resuming the rally we've seen since late March and April that could take us above 3,000? And like we've seen with the NASDAQ. So that's it for the catalyst this week that moved the market. Let's meet again next week as we look to see if either one of those levels gets taken out and what were the catalysts to drive that to happen.
Out of all the sectors that got hit the hardest by the COVID-19 global pandemic, one of those is the energy sector. This week, we caught up with Adam Rosenzweig to get an update on his outlook for the energy sector, how companies are operating, and what they're doing with oil prices in the $20 range, and what this means for the future of the energy sector as a whole. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
Demand for the month of April looks to be down anywhere between 25 to 30 million barrels a day. So you're talking about cutting global oil demand by about 30%. We're wiping out nearly three decades of demand growth. So, I mean, yeah, it was very, very material in an incredibly short period of time. And it really has overwhelmed the system.
To listen to this full interview with Adam Rosenzweig, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
It's been one heck of a recovery since the markets bottomed. Now they're starting to pull back. What does this mean? Will we retest the lows? Was this a bear market rally, or are we heading higher? Joining us on the program is Bullseye Craig Johnson from Piper Sandler. Craig, let's begin with the S&P. It got up to around the 200-day moving average, blew through the 50, but when it got up to the 200, started to stall. What does this mean?
You know, Jim, thank you first and foremost for having me back on the show today. And what I'm seeing in this market, I'll just start off by saying I believe the lows were made on March 23rd. I don't see a need to come back and retest the lows. And what I think this market is ultimately going to look like going forward from here is, and I know my colleagues kind of laugh at me when I say this, but I think this is going to look like some sort of square root sign, okay? Meaning February was your high, your March 23rd was your low. Somewhere here in May, June, right now, real time, we're going to start seeing this market transitioning from a recovery rally to more of a sideways time consolidation. And I think you would call that sort of an extended bull market recovery off of these lows. And I think that's what's going on right now. When I look at the price action you're seeing today, we're coming right down to this 2800 level, which has been a battle line in the sand looking all the way back to 2018, and it looks like it's being fairly well defended. And at the upper end, Jim, as you correctly noted, we got almost up to the 200-day moving average. We got up to around 2950, just below that 200-day moving average on the S&P, and we sort of stalled out there now a couple times. So I've been getting inbound calls, Jim. Is this a double top? Are we going to roll over and break back down and make new lows? And my answer to that is no. My answer is, consistently, I think we're going to be stuck in this sideways trading range that is probably going to be ballparkish, 3,000 on the S&P to 2,800, and we're going to spend probably the next several months consolidating sideways until we get a better indication of what's going to happen in the next major event coming up, which is going to be the election.
Craig, when you look at this and you see this bounce and this consolidation you see, is this more of reminiscent of what we normally see sometimes around this year? Sell in May, go away, come back after Labor Day?
I think that's an interesting view. I don't know if it's quite going to play out exactly that way, but it does tend to rhyme with it to a degree. I think this is more or less a market that got too overdone to the downside. We saw the recovery once we started to see a Federal Reserve that was going to come in and sort of do whatever needed to be done to support the bond market. And then it got layered in several fiscal stimulus packages, and the government clearly coming together on both the Republican and the Democratic side to build a proverbial bridge to get through this economic downturn. And it looks like they're putting enough stimulus in place to successfully build that bridge until we can start to see the jobless claims numbers really start to come down and start to see the country reopen again. And I think you're starting to see some early signs of that.
You have a year-end target. Let's talk about it, because it's right up there. And I'm sure you've gotten a lot of noise and flack over this, but let's discuss it.
Sure. So, Jim, you are correct. I have taken quite a bit of flack for having a number, a year-end objective on the S&P 500 of 3,600. And let me just say this. I've said it on your show before, but when I think about how do you value the markets, do you start with P first? Do you come back to E? You know, academia will tell you that you always have to start with E first to justify what P should be. But as a person that looks at charts, I start with P first. And we've developed at Piper Sandler this bottoms-up model that I've learned from prior technicians, some of them who have been on this show. And when we do this bottoms-up model, thinking about price and what it means for the Dow, what it means for the S&P, Jim, I got to tell you, that hasn't changed more than 2% since I established our target back in November, end of November, early part of December. And it still points toward an objective close to 3,600. Also, I would just mention, too, that if I go back and I look at all of the major peak-to-trough cycles from 1928 and year-to-date, I would make the first observation that it only took us about 16 days starting in end of February to reach bear market territory. It took us 12 to come out of it. But if I take all those prior peak to trough cycles, string them all out, look forward over the next year, it would be pointing to about 30, almost 3,300 on the S&P. And Jim, I get a little bit more excited when I see that here's what history has said, and then you start breaking down some of those prior, you know, peak to trough signals. And what I ultimately end up starting to think about is this going to play out more like 1987, given the amount of stimulus that we've put in and how quick the Fed and also the House and Senate have come together to put these packages. And I think that that 3,600 number, not only is it being supported by our bottoms up model, but certainly history is leading that way.
Let's then talk about what's doing well throughout this bull market. Technology has been a leader. It's been a leader on the way down, a leader on the way up, and then along with that, healthcare. And I can't help but think, Craig, the number of companies that are working on vaccines or a cure for COVID and how healthcare is becoming more important as the population ages. So let's talk about the sectors that you favor right now.
Yeah. So what I'm seeing literally with our work is we should be overweight tech, we should be overweight consumer cyclicals, and we should also be overweight healthcare. That's where I'm seeing the best relative strength happening in the market right now. It's also saying to me that we should be underweight utilities. We should also be underweight basic materials and also the communication media stocks at this point in time. Those are the three underweights. If you think about a barbell portfolio with how we think about the market with relative strength, that's what our models are saying to us. Jim, the interesting thing is those three sectors, tech, healthcare, consumer cyclical, ironically enough, when you go all the way back to the early 1900s, you find that those three sectors are also typically the best performing sectors from that coming off the bottom, looking forward over the next, say, 26 and 52 weeks after the lows are made. So not only do we have history on our side, but we're seeing history sort of rhyming with what we've seen in the past, because the relative strength is also showing us the exact same thing.
Now, what about energy? Energy has snapped back rather strongly, but I mean, this thing has been a dud for almost a decade. What's your views on the energy sector?
Well, the energy sector has been literally the best performing sector off of the lows. And that snapback rally has certainly left a lot of people scratching their heads and saying, you know, why is energy performing the way that it is performing coming off of these lows? And I think at this point in time, as I go back and I have conversations with not only investors, but also the terrific fundamental analysts that we work with. And I think right now, things are so bad in energy that there is definitely the opportunity for a more meaningful sort of relief rally to start to unfold that probably still has legs left to go. I find it really interesting when I go back and I look at over the last 4 weeks on an unweighted basis, we've seen energy up, you know, close to 16% over the last 4 weeks in our work on an unweighted basis. And on a weighted basis, you're up 8.5%. So it's been among the better performing areas off of these lows. But again, I think it really comes down to so many negative things have happened. If you would have said to me, Jim, that we're going to see oil prices actually go negative on the forward contract, I would have laughed. So they were literally paying people to take the oil because there was no storage left. I would not have imagined a scenario where that would have played out. But I think all the negativity is there, and hence why we are equally weight the energy sector at this point in time, even though it's a very small part of the market. I think it deserves an equal weight based upon what we're seeing.
You know, it's interesting. There's a saying in the industry, the cure for low prices is low prices. And the minister, finance minister of Saudi Arabia came out and said, basically, if we stay here in 3 to 4 years, we're bankrupt. So even at $20 oil, not only does nobody make money, and that includes anybody in the shale area, but also a lot of OPEC. I mean, Saudi Arabia needs $80 a barrel to balance their budget.
You know, there is going to be a right sizing that's going to take place, and you've got a combination of factors coming into play. You've got a green movement that is playing out and more people moving toward alternative energies and those things. But you also are in a scenario with the virus and how people are going to come back to work. And maybe you're going to have some A shifts and B shifts and things along those lines that come into play. You know, demand for oil might be continuing to be somewhat anemic here for the better part of the next year or two. But I'm not sure it gets a lot worse than where we're already at, because I think you've already gone through a lot of those the negative side of things. All around the world, in terms of OPEC, OPEC is doing what OPEC tries to do. They try to knock out competitors and use price as a bit of a weapon to do that. And certainly, I think that's what they were doing, and they were taking sort of a shot at some of the shale producers here in the U.S. But the administration, I think, has gone and had conversations with them to rethink their approach to that.
Yeah, I just, you know, we're going green. You're seeing more electric cars here in California. California is very green oriented. You've got a massive solar farm going into Vegas. It'll be the largest in the country. But Craig, I just don't see you and I getting on 787s that are going to be powered by batteries or those big ships that transport the goods across oceans, or for that matter, these gigantic trucks that bring everything to the store. And it's funny, I was reading a story about the best way to social distance now in terms of travel is people feel safer in their car than they do on a subway, a train, or let's say an airplane.
I agree with you on that. And I think you can take that concept one step even further. There's been such a movement over the years to basically go to this shared economy. You got shared cars, you got a shared bus, a shared tube system over in London and those kind of things. And it feels, and even a VRBOs and those kind of things. So I think you are going to see some of that shared economy take a little bit of a setback here in the near term. And I don't think the energy complex is going away. I think it's going to have a very long tail to it, as much as people want to go green. And you know, Jim, you and I have, you know, said over the years, like, even though you got an electric car, you got to somehow charge that car, and it's not all going to always be solar. So it's either going to be oil or coal or nat gas to do the generation for the electricity for those cars. So complex isn't going away anytime soon, no matter how much people want to make that transition. And in fact, Jim, when you've seen countries like Germany really start to shut down some of their nuclear production, they've actually had to start building coal plants to still have the electricity they need. They can't go green enough fast enough.
Craig, let's talk about something that has done rather well, and I'd like to get your input and perspective on gold, not only the bullion and commodity, but also the gold stocks.
So what I'm seeing with gold is, at the commodity level first, is gold is definitely starting to catch a bid. I still think that we need to see gold work above that sort of 1800 and change level to have a bigger, more meaningful breakout from my perspective. When I go through and I look at our industry groups, what I'm seeing with our industry groups at this point is I'm seeing a nice pickup. It's among the strongest and best performing inside of all of the industry groups that we've got, and certainly inside of the basic materials sector for sure. Stocks in there like Wheaton, precious metals have been some of the more attractive looking names for us that we've been focused on. And I still think for most people's portfolios, there's probably an opportunity to have a small slice there in gold. And I can understand why people want to have that small slice in gold, because the amount of printing of money that is going on at this point in time certainly is a little bit concerning. That is leading people to want to have this kind of hedge, if you want to call it that, in the gold stocks. But for me, it's just a slice. And for this to be a more meaningful breakout, We really need to move above that 1800 and change level on gold.
Let's move on to another sector, and that's interest rates. We've got the 10-year on the day you and I are talking, somewhere over 60 basis points. We had a gentleman on our show a couple of years ago, Craig, and he said oil was going down to 10 and the 10-year was going below 1%. You know, it's just like your forecast for 3600 on the S&P. He was told he was crazy. But here we are, below 1%. Oil actually got negative. So where do you see interest rates here?
Well, we should definitely provide that gentleman with a bullseye nickname, too, because he certainly hit that one square on. Where I see interest rates going at this point in time, I suspect that rates are going to be fairly stable in here. They're probably not going to be going up a whole lot. I look at where we're at with 10-year bond yields. I'm not a fan that we're going to be going negative rates. In fact, if you look at some of the commentary from Powell just yesterday, it doesn't sound like it has been an effective tool to go to negative rates, and some of the consequences and going to negative rates might outweigh the negative consequences that might outweigh the benefits of going into the negative rate environment. So I kind of think we're going to be in this kind of range that might be just sort of consolidating sideways. And for the year, maybe we're going to see at the upper end of the range, just sort of looking at the charts, that could be around 80 basis points, but probably sub 1% for the rest of the year for sure.
So if you had to put money to work right now, would you stay on the sidelines if you expect this consolidation maybe for the next 2 or 3 months? We just go sideways for the next couple months. Would you wait? Or would you be employing capital here at this point?
Well, I'd be using the little dips that we get along the way, and I would be looking at buying some of the more growth and larger cap stocks out there that look really attractive on the charts, include things like Amazon and certainly Netflix. And I know that these are stocks that people have talked about forever. But when you come back and you look at the charts and you look at where they're going and upside objectives in that, in Chipotle, and in Lulu, Athleta, these are all brands and charts that all look like they're not done working yet. And so I continue to steer people to be sort of in this NASDAQ 100-ish type world and definitely over-indexing on healthcare and consumer and tech. And I think that's where I would stay at this point. I think it's very difficult to go downstream into some of the mid and small cap names or to go into the industrials quite yet, because we don't have enough green shoots that the economy is really starting to turn yet. And we continue to look at the economic data coming out, and it still looks fairly troubled. So we're all trying to gauge how long this bridge has to be that we need to get across, that is getting put in by both the Fed and government at this point in time. And that's why I would rather just stay with those big, large cap names. I mean, Jim, to be honest with you, you look at a balance sheet of Apple and you ask yourself, who's got a better balance sheet at this point in time, the U.S. government or Apple? And you'd have to lean on Apple.
So as we're looking at this, one final question. Let's talk about one other market. That's emerging markets and the role of the dollar there. If you had to put money, would you put money in emerging markets? It doesn't seem like it's come back as strong. If you look at, the global markets, the U.S. seems to have the best looking shirt in a dirty laundry basket.
Totally. And I agree that the dollar is still in charge. It is still king dollar at this point in time. And if we're at the laundromat, the dollar is what you're picking up. Because at this point in time, if you're going to be printing money around the world, still the best place to do that is here in the U.S. And we still have positive rates and all the reason why I'd still continue to stay long the dollar. And because I'm going to be long the dollar, I'm going to look at these emerging markets and say, thank you very much, but I'll just sit on my hands for now and continue to buy the strongest and best currency and most attractive areas of the market, which is really going to be in your NASDAQ 100 type names.
So, Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Piper Sandler, how could they do so, please?
They're very welcome to send me an email, craig.johnson@psc.com, and I'll be happy to put them on a distribution list or have a conversation with them.
All right. Well, listen, Craig, stay safe and come back and talk to us again. Like I said, Craig's target, 3,600 at the end of the year. It'll be interesting to talk to you once again next time where we are on that goal. Thanks a lot, Craig.
Thank you, Jim.
FS Insider spoke with Leonard Brody about how there's a major reset of the global operating system underway. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
Human beings are nightmarishly bad at historical context. Because we only live on this planet for sort of 80 to 85 years, our concept of what is normal is in fact not normal at all. And you can point to almost anything from home ownership to cereal. None of these things are normal. At the turn of 1917, less than a third of Americans would have owned their own homes in an urban environment. And if they typically owned their homes, they built it with their own hands. They made it. And so when I talk about this rewrite or this reset, we have definitely been here before. You know, we have been in elements of our historical cycles where massive changes have occurred in human evolution and human behavior, and they were technologically assisted. We've seen these things before. The question is the scale of both the human change and the technological change different this time around? I would argue it is.
To hear this and all of our other FS Insider interviews airing 3 days every week through our website or through a podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
I've seen that all asset prices have been fluctuating this year with the coronavirus epidemic, but what about one important asset class, and that is real estate? How has the COVID-19 affected the real estate market? Has it strengthened it? Has it weakened it? Well, let's take a look. Joining us on the program is Ralph McLaughlin. He's chief economist with House and senior vice president of analytics. Ralph, let's talk about how this market has been affected. There's been a number of articles that have come out on the housing market. Barron's had one over the weekend. What I found was interesting, they said a third of all apartment renters did not pay their rent in the first week of April. They talked about consumer spending is down, but the housing market seems to be resilient. Explain that.
Yeah, well, great to be with you, Jim. And this is a bit of a conundrum. You know, you would think during probably the largest economic crash in U.S. history, you know, the housing market would falter along with it. And we're seeing the exact opposite. And, you know, we can kind of unpack that a little bit. You know, first, this was a planned recession, right? This was a planned downturn. We saw this coming. Most recessions we don't see coming. This one, we saw it coming. We planned for it. And there has been, you know, with some controversy, a very quick and swift government action. That's the good news. And if you think back to 2007, 2008, when the housing market was collapsing then, no one really knew what was going on, right? It took years for us to really figure out what the root cause of the housing market collapse was. Today, it's very, very different. Some of the first policies that the federal government and even some state governments have passed was a moratoria on foreclosures and a moratoria in some states on evictions. So right away, that's keeping people in their homes. So we don't see this drastic impact on foreclosures and evictions like we saw back in 2007, 2008. In addition, the big stimulus packages or disaster relief, wherever you want to call it, came through very quickly. I mean, we don't even have enough data yet to officially, you know, determine whether or not we are in recession. It's very likely we are. And already we have stimulus and disaster relief. So there's been demand preserved on that side, which is good news. To, I guess, help matters, sellers, because they're able to stay in their house, they're not forced to sell, have pulled back on what was, before this pandemic, historically low inventory. So we've seen supply plummet to levels we've never seen before, especially compared to the size of the U.S. population. So you have supply falling like crazy. You have, you know, both homeowners and to some extent renters that are protected, that aren't being forced to move or sell. And you have demand that's fallen, but hasn't fallen as much as supply, partially due to demographic headwinds. So it's for those reasons that the housing market so far looks like it's likely going to be a sale to the U.S. economy rather than an anchor.
You know, one of the interesting things about COVID-19 is how people are shopping for homes. They're basically, well, I think prior to COVID-19, they were doing it anyway, where you know, buyers go online, Zillow or other sites, they take a look at the pictures of the house and kind of do this screening because, you know, with COVID-19, if you're listing your house, I don't think you'd be comfortable with having people walk through your house or touching things. So how is this working? Are these transactions simply, they're all done online. You look at a house, you like it. But, you know, what do you do when you actually want to see it and buy it?
Yeah, that's great. You know, and the industry is sort of in parallel preparing for this approach to buying a house, you know, well before the pandemic. As you mentioned, a lot of the big real estate portals, you know, Redfin, Realtor.com, Zillow, you know, have all been moving towards giving a home buyer an immersive experience without actually having to see the house. You can do 3D tours. You can do, you know, live open houses where an agent's walking through. You can do a lot of document signing. You can apply for a mortgage all from the comfort of your couch. And the industry had been moving that way for quite a while. And so now actually is, you know, the housing market's going to be a lot better off because of that technology. It allows people to be able to buy a house really without ever having to set foot in a house. They can do digital signatures. You know, they, in many cases now, wet signatures are being waived. So what we're seeing now, of course, even though demand is falling back, it hasn't gone away. People are still buying homes and they're using technology to do it. Open houses today are you know, basically, I wouldn't say a thing of the past because they're likely to come back, but no one's holding open houses. What's happening is that professional photographers are coming through with high resolution cameras. They're doing 3D walkthroughs. So you can get online in these portals and you can literally walk anywhere in the house and have a look and get a feel for what it's like to live there. There are still opportunities if homes are not occupied to visit a house. You know, usually what's happening is home buyers will get a private tour, you know, coming with full protective, personal protective equipment to see the house if they need to. And then submitting all offers digitally, you know, applying for a mortgage digitally. So we are seeing the industry really adapt, and probably the pace of adaptation by necessity is quickening. And, you know, what typically has been somewhat of a hesitation, I think, by the industry to adapt this technology, you know, has completely turned 180 to use it because, you know, that's the way to make things happen. I mean, Jimmy, I don't know if you could imagine even 20 years ago, 30 years ago, if we had a pandemic like this, whether or not anyone would ever be able to buy or sell a house. I mean, you could think, you know, just 20 years ago that this would be catastrophic. So I think technology, to your point, is really going to help the housing market stay afloat during this, you know, during these unprecedented times.
I want to talk about something that existed in the last housing crisis. A lot of millennials were out of work. They couldn't find jobs. They were living at home. That situation has changed. According to Barron's, there's 72 million millennials ranging from age 24 to 39 that are moving into their peak nesting years and kind of moving from the inner city to, let's say, the suburbs where they can raise a family. You know, a six-month-year-old kid crying in an apartment complex may not sound right versus, let's say, having a house in the backyard in the suburbs.
That's right. You know, I think the adage that millennials and Gen Z are going to be inner city dwellers for their entire life is really starting to, you know, get broken down. Just before the pandemic, we had the release of the homeownership and vacancy rate survey, the quarterly homeownership vacancy rate survey, which was conducted on about March 12th of this year. So right before the pandemic really started to take root in the U.S. And what we saw is the highest number of new homeowners in the U.S. on record at over 2 million compared to the same time in the previous year. At the same time, the number of renters in the U.S. actually fell by about 600,000. And so what that means, that suggests that there is a shift from renting to ownership. And guess what? The cohort that has seen the biggest increase in their homeownership rate over that time period were households under 35. So if it weren't for this young large pool of potential home buyers in the U.S., we wouldn't see the homeownership rate move at all. And it's likely we wouldn't have seen as large of an increase in the number of homeowners in the country. So, you know, this is actually very, very good news for those that pay attention to the housing market, for those that are invested in the housing market. It means that owner occupancy demand is likely to continue to grow over the next 2, 5, even 10 years as this cohort comes of age and as they tend to buy homes in the suburbs, and that's increasing the way they're doing it. So this is very positive news for growth in the U.S. housing market over the next 5 to 10 years.
How would you contrast this housing cycle versus the one that preceded it in the last decade, Ralph? I was writing about what I was seeing at the turn of the century about what was happening here in California: no money down, no doc loans, builders opening up multiple building sites in phases with spec homes. There were articles in Fortune and Business Week of people buying, going into an area like Phoenix or maybe Vegas and buying several homes at a time because everybody was making money. And then that came to an end. What I've seen, at least around here, is builders have been more circumspect. If they're going to have a 7-phase development, they'll release phase one, and they're not going to build another home until that phase is entirely sold. So they've been a lot more circumspect. The other thing that we went through in building our own home, it took about 6 months longer because the builder had a hard time getting the subs to do various jobs of building our home because they just weren't available.
Yeah, Jay, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, Jim. The housing market today, even before and just after this pandemic, couldn't look any different than it did back in 2006, 2007. Point number one, in 2007, we were basically at a record high inventory. Today, we're, even before the pandemic, we're at record low inventory. Back 10, 11, 12 years ago, lending was very loose and, one could argue perhaps reckless. Today, the credit box has remained, relatively rigid. There's been some expansion of credit over the past 2 years, but nowhere near the expansion that happened back in the mid-aughts. Back in 2006, 2007, we had a demographic structure that was very different. Gen X, had bought homes. But they were so small that there, wasn't much of a solid bottom for the market just because millennials and Gen Z weren't in the home buying years yet. So there wasn't that big demographic cushion to help support the market through a tough time. Home builders were building like crazy back in 2006, 2007, just like you mentioned. And today, they're only building at about 70 to 80% of the historic levels of home building, partially because they're, being a little bit more prudent. Those that survived the Great Recession, have learned how to not be reckless and lose out. But, also arguably in some places it is, it's more difficult to find labor. It's more difficult to find subs. And in some places, land use regulations certainly are getting in the way of building, especially building up, in places where, there might be, higher demand for increased densities. There are often land use regulations that are, preventing those densities from reaching market levels. So that makes development, especially multifamily housing, difficult. Now, in some areas, single family housing has come back, as you mentioned, starting to come back in places, like Phoenix and Vegas and the Southwest and South, where it's relatively easy to build. But again, I can't reiterate, even though we are going through a very sharp economic contraction, how different the housing market looks today than it did back in 2007.
Ralph, how much will COVID-19 also change the housing market? For example, in our own business, we've been operating remotely from our homes for 2 months now. And a lot of companies I've been reading are saying, we can do this. Maybe I've seen several large insurance companies that are going to be consolidating their offices, fewer offices, and having a lot of their agents work remotely. So how much will this change the workplace as a result of this? I mean, in California, you get on the freeway, you're in a traffic jam. Much easier to work from home and more efficient.
That's a great question, Jim. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about this lately. And I've got a very simple equation that will tell you theoretically what that would be. And it is the share of all people who are currently living in cities, but otherwise would prefer to live in maybe the exurbs or rural areas, and you multiply that times the share of employers who have suddenly become accepting of a remote-based workforce. If you multiply those two things together, that will tell you how much exodus we will see from cities to rural areas. Now, it's perhaps that one of those shares is zero, but if either of those shares is non-zero, we will see a net increase of people working outside of cities, working remotely rather than working within cities. Now, I think you're going to see a lot of variation by industry. By no means am I suggesting that cities are going to go away. In fact, I think the agglomeration forces, the agglomeration economies of cities are even more important than they ever have been. But what it means, though, is that people might spend less time living in cities and more time visiting cities to take advantage of those agglomeration economies in the workforce. Industries, employers, you know, are likely still to want a place to congregate and share knowledge, but it doesn't mean that all of their employees have to work in those locations. And that actually bodes well for demand, we think, to some extent, again, depending on, you know, how positive that equation is that I just described, in areas outside cities. And, you know, certainly one approach that we're taking at House, you know, is definitely for the rest of this year and possibly indefinitely in the future, is having a remote, you know, option. And, you know, like I plan on spending, you know, the rest of this year and much of next year working in a secluded canyon in the Sierra Nevada. So, you know, I'm sort of going to vote with my feet when it comes to that. So great question, Jim.
Ralph, what about also how this will change what a house looks like? I just think of growing up with my family, you know, the house had the bedroom, she had the kitchen, and you had a living room. Then we added the family room or the great room. And a lot of the new homes today don't have a formal living room. They have a great room where you incorporate the dining room. And with people working remotely, will having a home office be a regular feature of new homes?
It absolutely could be. You know, we've seen the evolution of living spaces and over time, like you mentioned, you know, we start to become more comfortable as a society with remote work as much as possible. There's going to be probably demand for more formal office spaces, workspaces. You know, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had during the lockdown with both coworkers and other colleagues outside of my company, where literally people were taking phone calls and meetings from closets, from walk-in closets, because that was the only space they could get because their spouse or their kids were off making noise someone else. And so, you know, I think that probably is going to get people to rethink, you know, what kind of living spaces they want in their house. And, you know, we have at least seen some of the transition of that. I know there's been some work out there that has showed searches for home offices and real estate listings has increased pretty significantly over the last few months. And actually demand for bedrooms, all else equal, is looking like it's waning a bit. And in fact, you know, analysis I did about a year ago was starting to show the impact of an extra bedroom on a house, all else equal, was negative. It actually detracted from the value of the house for a house of the same size. So if you had a house that was, say, 3,000 square feet and one that had three bedrooms and one that had two bedrooms, the one with two bedrooms was actually more valuable if that other square footage was dedicated to a great room. So, you know, we are seeing pretty, you know, rapid changes in demand. And I wouldn't be surprised, to your point, that homes with workspaces, at least for this pandemic, but maybe even, you know, into the indefinite future, would sell for a higher premium than homes without, say, a more formal workspace.
It looks like year-over-year housing prices are still going up. Are there any areas that are overpriced or underpriced as you look around the country, Ralph?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, things aren't looking too great in the short term for markets that were already very expensive before the pandemic. So, you know, think of your San Francisco's, you know, your Seattle's, your New York's. Those places were already very expensive. And so when you had a very large shutdown, you know, and certainly some employers in those markets have started to lay off employees, you're likely to see probably much more cooling in those markets than, say, other areas of the U.S. You know, I'm thinking about places like, you know, the Midwest, in particular Ohio, and into Tennessee, and Kentucky, and even down into the south of Texas, with the exception of Houston, of course, that are still relative bargains and, for the most part, weren't hit too hard by the coronavirus. And so, you know, we think those markets are going to be the ones that actually help carry us out of this pandemic. And that's actually almost the exact opposite of what we saw during the last recession, when it was the quote unquote superstar cities that I just mentioned that actually pulled the U.S. housing market into a period of recovery. You know, we think it's exactly opposite. We think those markets are the ones that are going to be the hit hardest, and they're going to take the longest to recover. And it's these other markets that are, again, in the South, you know, in the Midwest, that are really going to help the housing market recover over the next 6 to 12 months.
And I just wonder, too, if that'll change people's behavior. You talked about the markets that are overpriced, certainly California. You look at San Francisco, even L.A., in San Diego. And then you look at these large, crowded cities like New York, which was the epicenter of the COVID-19. And then you take a look at other areas where the cost of living is cheaper. You mentioned Texas. Some states don't have taxes. I mean, last Friday, our governor announced we have a $57 billion deficit, the largest in California's history, as a result of this COVID-19. So you just wonder if there's going to be a migration, as I know Tesla is threatening to pull out. They would be the last car manufacturer in California. If you're going to see this transition as well, where people will be moving to areas that are less crowded, less expensive, less taxes, and let's say a more comfortable living space than crowded freeways.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly possible, and we've seen some evidence of that over the last couple years or so. Certainly, we've seen some migration from California to places like Texas, both migration of firms, but also migration of households. You know, we've seen even before that migration from California out up into Seattle and Denver. In fact, if you've visited Seattle or Denver any time over the past 5 years or so, you probably will have come across, you know, some expat Californians. So, you know, we certainly think this trend could continue into the future if affordability remains to be very, very tight. And again, you know, we expect home price growth to start to cool off somewhat in those markets. They do tend to be hotbeds of innovation. So we do think that, again, the agglomeration economies are going to help, but it's likely we'll see a migration of middle class or even households on the lower end of the income distribution move out simply because it's not worth it for them to live in those places. And to make matters worse, if there are policies that make, and housing affordability policies are certainly one, but if there are other policies that make doing business in some of these markets, you know, not easy, and it, you know, by no means has it necessarily been easy to do business in California, but if it gets worse, you know, there is a tipping point where some firms might leave. But, you know, California, despite that, you know, does have a very educated population. It's got, you know, great weather. And those are things that are sticking points. And those are things that are always going to be pull factors. But you know, to some extent, I don't care how strong the pull factors are, there is some point where the push factors would be enough that both firms and households, you know, leave California to a point where perhaps population growth slows to zero or maybe even turns negative.
So given your perspective looking at the housing market, you see housing doing very well over the next couple of years, especially driven by a demographic change, especially millennials as they move into their prime earning years and nesting years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, certainly the housing market isn't going to get off completely scot-free, right? We are going to see price growth fall. I mean, we don't think price growth is going to fall much below zero, if at all. But certainly I think price growth is going to moderate close to being flat for a period of time. Home sales are going to be hit very, very hard. Home sales right now are already dropping about 40-50% year over year. But we think the housing market itself is going to rebound, you know, quite quickly, again, mostly because of the demographic factors that we have. So, you know, all else equal, housing now looks like, you know, more of a solid investment space than, say, other sectors. Certainly, you know, the volatility of oil, you know, makes that a little less attractive, especially, you know, in the short run. So, you know, the stock market certainly has been quite volatile over the years. So housing, even though maybe it hasn't, you know, delivered the returns that some of those industries have delivered, you know, prior to the pandemic, although returns have been pretty decent in the housing market, you know, I don't think we're going to see, you know, relatively speaking, a lot of investors of housing lose their shirts like some have, you know, especially those that were in equities and in oil. So relatively speaking, I emphasize this, relatively speaking, you know, the U.S. housing market does look very solid, you know, both in the short run and especially in the medium to long run.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, as we close, would you mind sharing information about your company, what you do, and how our listeners could find out more?
Yeah, absolutely. I am with a company called HouseNow. We are a relatively new startup. We are a company that offers an alternative to housing finance. So we actually co-invest with homebuyers instead of giving them a mortgage. That means we share in the upside. We also share in the downside, and we offer quite a bit of flexibility when it comes to, say, taking cash out from the partnership to, you know, say, do home improvements. Or, and what's especially important today, is if someone loses a job, we will allow that person for an undefined number of months to just stop paying if they need to until they get back on their feet. And we will slowly buy shares back from them during that time period. After they get back on their feet, they can just pick up right where they left off, and there's no harm to their credit. There's no foreclosure. There's no eviction. So we think this is a much fairer, more equitable type of product to buy a house than a mortgage. If you want to read more about how our product works, and if you want to read more about the housing market forecast that we're putting out and other sorts of commentary that me and my team are writing about, you can go to www.house.com/resources.
All right. Well, listen, Ralph, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. Stay safe and all the best, and come back again.
Very happy to, Jim. Thanks again. Always a pleasure joining you.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Smart Macro, where, as always, we speak with Financial Sense Wealth Management's Chief Investment Officer, Chris Poplava. So you just wrote a piece titled Alphabet Soup, Will the Markets and Economy Feel the Love? And that's L-U-V. As we discussed last time, 2 weeks ago, we've seen a V in the markets so far, and that's because of the unprecedented amount of stimulus we've seen. However, as you said, we're more likely to see some form of a U, a longer-shaped recovery in the economy itself. I know you talked about best worst-case scenarios in your piece, which we will link out to where this interview is located on Financial Sense. But kick things off for us, if you wouldn't mind, Chris, on what you're looking at currently.
Looking at this market, clearly we've had an inflection point in equities. A couple of other things I'm looking at is to see other inflection points. If you look at earnings estimates for the second quarter for the S&P as well as for the full year of 2020, it does look like we're getting close to the bottom, where every week I'm looking at what the earnings estimates are and they continue to worsen. But I think we're, you know, looking at sequentially, we're almost at the point where I think we might be, you know, 1 to 2 weeks off from seeing a bottom in those estimates, that meaning that they're going to stop being revised down. That would be an inflection point in earnings and earnings estimates for the market. Secondly, I want to look for an inflection point in the economy. We've already seen that in jobless claims. If you look at the initial weekly jobless claims, those have peaked. We're still, unfortunately, seeing initial jobless claims in the millions, but still way off the highs, which was, I believe, north of 6 million back in March. So we've seen an inflection point in jobless claims, but in the general economy, looking at production, retail sales, and other metrics, wanted to see an inflection point there. But back to the markets, one of the areas I'm looking at very keenly on to look for an inflection point is the weekly flows into money markets. Now, the reason why I do that is, to me, if we see an inflection point in money markets, that would tell me that that money is now leaving money markets and has to go somewhere. Where is it going? Is it going into bonds, whether that's corporate bonds, treasuries, foreign bonds, or is it going into equities, and what kind of equities? So that's something I'm looking at very closely, because once we saw a peak in money market assets back in 2009, that's what helped to lead to a sustained bull market. But while we had those interim rallies of that bear market in 2008, for example, the March rally, we had a pretty sizable bounce. After the October plunge of 08, we had a pretty sizable bounce. But all of those were short-lived. They weren't sustained because money market assets were still building as people were selling their equities. So I want to look for a peak there. And if you look at year to date, we've seen $1.2 trillion go into money markets. Other winners have been gold at $27 billion. Technology sector has gotten $22 billion flows this year. Healthcare at $20 billion. And, but in terms of the losers for this year, global equities, U.S. equities, emerging markets, even investment grade debt, there's a lot of fear of fallen angels, essentially investment grade triple B bonds getting derated to junk, and concern there that that could lead to a sustained, you know, lower move there. But again, the Fed's in there now. You know, the Fed's supporting the market. The Fed's now buying bond ETFs. So the Fed is providing support there. But for me, you know, looking at that inflection point in money markets will be very key to see when that occurs.
So it sounds like you're lining up with more of a bullish thesis. We're either at or close to an inflection point when we look at earnings, when we look at jobless claims, which is a weekly near real-time indicator of the economy. And then again, the thing that you're looking for as well, which we haven't seen yet, is a peak in flows into money market. So basically, once we see money market funds, that's where people are holding their cash, move back into the market. That's also for you going to be a significant sign that we've seen a turning point. Did I get that correct?
That's correct. And so, you know, once we see that, typically what that means is that money's coming back into the market. And, you know, the money comes in more aggressively whenever you see a pullback. And so with the market starting to pull in here over the last week or so, to me, it's encouraging to see that the amount of money going into money markets has significantly slowed down, such that we actually might see our first week of outflows soon. B of A, according to all the assets that they manage and observe, they're seeing that from their clients, a net outflow from cash. But what I'm looking at is the ICI company who tracks mutual funds and ETF flows. I'm looking at the total net amount in money market assets. And we're almost at the inflection point of seeing negative weekly outflows. But for me, I don't just want to see 1 week. I want to see something sustained. So another thing I'm looking at is the monthly flows, or, you know, a 4 week moving average. So that kind of helps to filter out the noise. We've already seen an inflection there in terms of the amount of money going into money markets, very similar to jobless claims. Both have peaked, but they're still positive. And I'll be looking for that 4 week moving average to also start to turn negative. And I think if we do see any kind of weakness in the market, it will be very important to see, what do investors do? Are they still fearful? And if the market rolls over, are they raising more cash, or are they using weakness to put cash to work? So that's something I'm watching. I think it's going to be the latter, meaning that in the last week, with the market starting to show some weakness, the pace of money going into money markets has certainly declined. Additionally, one of the other things I look at is when you see the, you know, in bear market bottoms, usually sentiment, bear sentiment really rises. And that's because people are bullish at the tops and they're bearish at the bottoms. And so in bear markets, when you kind of see, it's not a straight line. And after a significant decline, you see bear sentiment really pick up. And then you get a relief rally, a false bottom, you know, essentially a bear market rally. And as that occurs, you start to see bear sentiment begin to recede. Let me give you an example of that. You know, looking at the 2007-2009 bear market, the American Association of Individual Investors, the bear sentiment, or those that were bearish, was roughly 60% as we headed into the March bottom. And then that was, we had our first relief rally in the spring of 08. And by the time that rally began to peter out late May, the percent bears went from roughly over 60 all the way down to 25. So essentially the bears disappeared and then the market rolled over again. And at the final bottom in March of 2009, the percent bears were all close to 70%. So what I'm looking for is if we're still in a bear market, I would expect to see before we have another leg down. A lot of people believe that this rally off the bottom is over and we're now going to proceed into a new leg down and either retest or possibly exceed those lows. Well, to see another sustained move down, I would expect to see bear sentiment evaporating, meaning that there's some cash that could still be pulled out of the market. That sentiment could worsen from here. And when I'm looking at current sentiment right now, we're at about 51% bearish readings. And that's about where we were at the bottom of the mini bear in 2018. It's about roughly where we were at the bottom in late 2015, early 2016. So with bear sentiment at roughly, you know, I would say almost a 8 to 7 year high, I don't think, you know, the sentiment is there to support the argument that we're headed lower. So with bear sentiment elevated, with plenty of cash on the sidelines, and that cash, that pace of that cash hoard is starting to slow down, I do think that at worst, I think we go sideways or maybe a small decline, you know, maybe from the recent peak, maybe 5-10%. But in light of what we've just been through, I would say that's pretty mild.
Chris, something that we touched upon 2 weeks ago was a study that you did looking at bear market bottoms and the bounces that we've seen after a major bear market bottom. And you actually have this data in your Alphabet Soup piece, which again, we'll have linked out to so that people can look at some of the numbers and some of the projections that could come from that. But would you mind going into that for our audience today?
Sure. One of the things that I wanted to determine is what differentiates a bear market bounce, you know, a dead cat bounce, versus a new bull market, meaning that it's the real deal. The bottom is in, not just a bottom, but the bottom, meaning the bear market is over. And one of the things that I used as a differentiating point was when we've retraced half of the prior bear market, what happens after that point? And I was analyzing all bear markets in the post-World War II era. And when we've gone through that point of retracing half the bear market after falling at least 20%, we've had 13 cases of this. In only one case did we ever make a new low. And that was in the 1946-1949 bear market coming out of World War II. But absent that bear market, the other 12 cases never saw the market hit a new low when it retraced at least half of its decline. Now, another milestone that we made recently was we retraced 61.8% of the prior bear market. And that's another key retracement level that a lot of technicians look at. And when we've hit that objective, and we've done that 12 times since the post-World War II era, we've never hit a new low. So what I wanted to see is, okay, if we don't hit a new low after we've gone through at least a 50% retracement, what does the market do if it doesn't hit a new low? Does it pull back and see a significant decline, but not to a new bottom? Does it continue higher, or is it just trade sideways? And so what I did is I took a look at that starting point. So once that 50% retracement mark was met, what did the market do? And I rebased all of those S&P bull market rallies to where we are presently at that 50% mark to give a projection of what it might look like for the S&P in the present case. And what I plotted, and this will be up on the web, is the average of those 12 bull market rallies, the worst case scenario and the best case scenario. And interestingly enough, we're more or less following the average case. And the argument I was making for our clients is that if I just look at the worst and best case scenario over the next 3 to 6 months, in terms of downside and upside, essentially, if we stayed within the confines of the best and worst case scenario, our downside could be on the S&P roughly 2,600, and the potential on the upside is a new all-time high. There were several bull markets that hit new all-time highs within 6 months from the market bottom. And so that would be obviously the best case scenario. But if we just follow the average case, we're going to see a slow grind higher. But more importantly than the upside is mostly for people, they look at the downside. What's my risk? And for me, if you look at the present case, you know, we're a little bit above 2,800, you know, 200 point decline in the S&P, that really shouldn't faze anyone after what we've just lived through. So far, I take that as encouraging that once we have gone through a 50% retracement of the prior bear market, that usually has marked the bottom 12 out of the last 13 times, and we're following the average case. So, you know, seeing the market weak here over the last week or two, that's not surprising. You know, we're still within the confines of average and normal. So unless we really start to pick up some pace below, I would say 2,600 or a little bit below that, and I also see some credit worsening indicators, you know, I feel the market is doing what it has done historically.
Anything else that you're looking at that's framing your investment outlook?
One of the things that I'm taking note of, and we've been, you know, progressively adding exposure to the area for our clients, is the precious metals market. When we've looked at precious metals, usually you see sustained bull markets or secular bull markets in precious metals with some kind of a catalyst. In the 70s, we had obviously the Bretton Woods Agreement where the U.S. was taking off the gold standard. We were paying for the Vietnam War, and we saw credit card issuance was really starting to pick up some steam. So that money was getting to the system, money velocity picked up, inflation picked up, and commodities did quite well, including gold and silver and oil. And in the prior secular bull market in precious metals, we saw the bottom occur in 2001. That was after a major peak in the U.S. dollar. We saw the catalyst there also being 9/11. You know, after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the U.S. dramatically increased our deficit spending to pay for the wars that we saw there. So the U.S. amount of debt outstanding really began to explode. That put some weakness on the dollar, and we saw some strength in precious metals and commodities in general. I think what we're seeing right now is the next catalyst to lead to a sustained secular move in precious metals. What's, you know, a lot of people don't see, and that's because we here in the U.S., you know, we live and breathe in U.S. dollars, is looking at gold and other currencies. It's clear that gold has begun a new bull market. Virtually in every currency except for the U.S. dollar, gold is at a new all-time high. Whether you can at euros, yen, Australian dollars, Canadian dollars, other Asian currencies, gold has hit new all-time highs in the last year, except for the dollar. But I think we're going to, in the next, I would say, 6 to 12 months, I would not be surprised to see a new high in gold in dollar terms. And what I'm looking at, and we've been slowly building an allocation to gold for our clients, as well as precious metal stocks, is the mining stocks have finally broken out. Now, gold is much closer to its 2011 highs, but mining stocks are still way off their highs, roughly half of where they were back in the highs in 2011. And there's what I look for is also the amount of money that's gone into ETFs, so precious metals, bullion, or mining ETFs. And I look at volume by price. So I essentially look at, okay, over the last 5-10 years, where's the volume been? At what price level? And for mining stocks, the bulk of the volume that we've seen, you know, 90% plus has occurred below the current price. So that tells me there's a lot of support below where we are with precious metals stocks and not a lot of resistance ahead of us. And I'm also seeing that not only in gold miners, but also in silver miners. The silver stocks are even lower than the price of gold. The price of gold and gold mining stocks have exceeded their 2016 highs. The same cannot be said for silver miners. They're still well below the highs that they saw in 2016 and certainly well below the highs that they saw in 2011. So I think silver to me is really interesting here, precious metals in general, but particularly silver. I do think that silver could begin to start to play catch up to gold, and it looks very attractive to me.
What would account for that catch up, and why is silver now starting to see a pretty significant move?
We tend to see when things get to an extreme, kind of like a rubber band, they can only go so far and then they snap back. And often at times when they hit major extremes, they snap back violently. And when you look at the gold to silver ratio, and I've got data going back to the 1970s, we had never seen gold as high relative to the price of silver as we did recently. The gold to silver ratio was north of 124. And to give you some context for that, the average ratio is just under 60. And when we were in a full-blown mania in 2011, the gold-to-silver ratio was all the way down to as low as 31, where gold was 31 times more expensive to silver. And so we've literally come to polar opposites of the gold-silver ratio from the 2011 mania peak to the recent spike low in silver recently, where gold was 124 times more expensive. But I think we might have seen the peak in the gold-silver ratio. We've come off from 124, we're presently at 105, and I do think that we could see silver begin to appreciate more aggressively than gold, driving down that ratio even lower. To give you some context in terms of why I'm attracted to silver at the present time, currently with gold today at $1,746 an ounce, silver at $16.55 an ounce, just using the average gold-silver ratio of 58, that would imply, if holding gold constant, that would require silver to appreciate from $16.50 to $30 an ounce, which would be an 81% upside. Now, something more conservatively, we saw a major spike in the gold-silver ratio in March when things collapsed. Gold held up while silver, copper, other base metals collapsed. And if we went just back to the pre-March crisis spike in the gold-silver ratio, that ratio at the time, just before the spike, was 87.2. So that would imply a silver price of $20 an ounce, or roughly a 21% upside to present levels. So, you know, if you just go to pre-March crisis levels of the gold-silver ratio, or even at the average, to me, I think there's a lot of upside to the price of silver.
Chris, you sent me a chart looking at gold priced in many different currencies around the world. As you noted earlier, we have not yet seen gold hit new highs in dollar terms, but it has hit highs in many other currencies. So how does that factor into your analysis of the potential strength of a new bull market in the precious metal space?
One of the other catalysts that I commonly see that leads to a tipping point, not only in the peak of the gold-silver ratio, but also the bottom, is the dollar. For example, when we're in a period of crisis, people flock to gold. They don't flock to silver. And so you can see funds going to safe havens like the dollar and gold. And so it's not uncommon to see the gold-silver ratio rise and the dollar index rise. And again, that's because money's flowing into safe havens during times of crisis. But in periods where the dollar is dramatically falling and liquidity is rampant all over, that's when we see the gold-silver ratio really fall. And so that's one of the things I'm taking a look at is we have seen the dollar hold up very well recently, hitting, you know, new multi-year highs. The gold-silver ratio obviously hitting an all-time high here recently. I'm really watching the dollar, and I want to see the dollar pull in, because if it does, to me, that would be kind of the big catalyst to supercharge this move in silver relative to the price of gold. And I do think that could be something we see on the horizon. You know, when I look at the price of gold, to me, one of the important things to look at is you want to see strong breadth. You know, Bob Farrell, he was a legendary investor at Merrill Lynch. What he had a famous 10 rules to remember. One of them is, markets are strongest is when they're broad and weakest when breadth is low. And to gauge precious metals in terms of the breadth of a move, I look at the price of gold in other currencies. And I've looked at over 30 world currencies priced, gold priced in over 30 world currencies. And when I see gold advancing, not just against the dollar or a few currencies, when I see it advancing virtually against every world currency, to me, that tells me this move is real, it's sustained, and it's got some legs to it. And that's exactly what I see. You know, for example, today, gold priced in every world currency that I track is up. Against the Australian dollar, it's up over 4% just today alone. Against the Iceland kroner, it's up about 0.25% on the low end. But it's up universally across most currencies I look at. On a one-day basis, I also look at it on a three-month, six-month, a one-year basis. And again, gold is up against all of those currencies. Secondly, I look at the dollar in terms of its exchange rate to other currencies. And what I want to see is that world currencies start to show some positive returns relative to the U.S. dollar. And as of right now, I'm seeing that maybe in half of the currencies are up against the dollar in the last month, but longer term, you know, 1 month, 3 month, or even the last 5 days, in general, most currencies are down compared to the dollar. So I don't think we've seen necessarily the peak in the dollar. I do see a sustained move in gold, given that it's rallying against almost every currency. But in terms of the, you know, the gold-silver ratio really starting to collapse even further beyond what it's already done in the last month, I think we need to see a lower move in the dollar. I do think that's coming. In the next 12 months, I would not be surprised to see the dollar anywhere from 10 to 15% lower. I don't know if we've hit that tippy point yet.
Do you think the outperformance that we've seen in gold, and as you said earlier, you know, you think silver's going to play a catch up in that as well. Do you think a large part of this has to do with the fact that we're seeing, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars now being printed by the Fed and U.S. government? 2 weeks ago, we talked about how it amounted to $12 to $13 trillion when you add all of it up. So that's a massive amount of money. But do you think that is really what's driving gold and silver higher at this point?
I do. You know, and if you look at, as I was mentioning, gold is up virtually against every world currency. And, you know, if you look at any central bank in the world, they're all either printing money and or cutting interest rates. So if you look at the global central banking system, the world is awash in fiat currency. And that's because of in response to this crisis. But even more than that, the world economy was relatively weak due to the U.S.-China trade war that was really beginning to drag on. And so we are seeing a tremendous amount of global stimulus, which is why it's not surprising to see gold up against every currency. But looking at the dollar, you know, the U.S. is king in terms of stimulus right now. I mean, if you look at the amount of monetary stimulus, fiscal stimulus that the U.S. is doing, no one even comes close. And I'm doing this normalized as a percent of GDP. So not just on an absolute basis, but on a relative basis, no one's even coming close to the amount of stimulus that the U.S. has. And that's why I am bearish longer term on the dollar. I do think that we could see the dollar weaken here because there's a lot of things that are making that case. One of the things I look at is U.S. 10-year interest rates relative to other sovereign countries' yields. And whenever U.S. yields are rising relative to foreign yields, that leads to an attractive proposition to move into U.S. bonds and currencies versus others. And we tend to see the price of the dollar rise to that. And whenever we see foreign yields begin to rise relative to the dollar, we tend to see the dollar weak. And one thing I looked at since 2007, it's what the average spread was of U.S. 10-year rates above other sovereign yields. And we're at a negative 2 standard deviation event. The last time we saw this was in 2011. That's when the U.S. dollar index was below 80. We also saw this in 2008, just before the dollar had a huge rally and gold was hitting new highs there. And so if we were just following the general trends, whenever we've seen the spread at a negative 2 standard deviation event, that would imply a price of the dollar index at about roughly 90. And we're north of 100 currently. So I do think there's, you know, upwards of a 10% correction possible in the dollar index, just looking at interest rate spreads of U.S. versus others. Let me give you an example. If you look at U.S. 10-year rates relative to Japanese 10-year yields, we are at the lowest level since 2011, 2012. And this was back when gold was nearly $2,000 an ounce. The yen was about 80 to the dollar, so it took 80 yen roughly to buy $1. And currently right now, it takes 107 yen to buy $1. So this would imply that the yen should be far stronger than where it is right now compared to the dollar, just looking at interest rate differentials alone. And even further than that, if you look at Germany, I'm looking at U.S.-German 10-year yield spreads. And about a year ago, we were almost 3% spread, meaning that you could get 3% more in a 10-year treasury versus a 10-year German Bund. And we've come off of that, but we're, you know, just over a 1% spread. But, you know, I'm not seeing the euro rally significantly to follow that differential spread. And that's because U.S. rates have collapsed relative to the rest of the world. So, you know, a year ago when U.S. had significantly higher interest rates than everyone else, it made sense that the dollar was strong. But when you look at yield spreads now, it does argue for a weaker dollar. And another thing that I've seen Jeff Gundlach over at DoubleLine cite for his bearish views on the dollar is our twin deficits. When you look at our budget and our trade deficit combined, it tends to lead the dollar index by about 12 to 18 months. And obviously, we've seen an explosion in our budget deficit that should put pressure on the dollar for the next year. So I do think over the next 12 months, I do think we're going to eventually see a peak in the dollar relative to foreign currencies, and that will be sustained. I don't know if we've seen it just yet, but I do expect it to occur. And when that happens, I do think that would be the big catalyst to send silver, see that significantly outperform the price of gold.
So, Chris, again, you are the Chief Investment Officer at our firm, Financial Sense Wealth Management. You lead the investment strategy, monitor the client accounts, help with rebalancing portfolios. A lot of the things, of course, that have to do with the nuts and bolts of putting what we said into practice. With that said, would you mind putting all that we discussed today in the context of what you're doing for clients at Financial Sense Wealth Management and some of the investment implications?
Sure. The big thing that our opinion is that the bottom is in. I do not think we're going to retest the lows. And obviously, I don't think we're going to go lower than that because of all the stimulus that's been applied, all the money that's already come out of the stock market. And for that reason, I don't think we're going lower. And so we were at a minimum risk posture for clients in terms of equities. We're now at a neutral position. And there is a limit in terms of how much we can go in terms of equities, because we are invested in precious metals, which takes away from that. But we have been scaling into our precious metals over the last year, particularly in light of the recent move that we've seen in gold. I think it's finally going to have a sustainable market out. Again, I do believe that we'll see a new all-time high in gold in dollar terms in the next 12 months. I think we'll also see a sustained move lower in the dollar index over the next 12 months. So I'm quite bullish on precious metals. And in terms of fixed income, I do think that we've seen the lows in interest rates. So I think they're probably going to be having a slow, marginal grind higher. I don't think we're going to see a significant rise in interest rates. I know there's a massive amount of supply coming due, but we've got a big deflationary wave we got to push through. And that's on the labor front in terms of how many are unemployed, which will be putting pressure on wages. And even in terms of spare capacity of production. We've got a lot of the productive part of the economy shut in. And so that will be weighing on prices in general. So I don't expect to see inflation rise meaningfully in the year ahead. I do think it will probably trend higher than where it is currently. But because I don't see runaway inflation, I also don't see runaway interest rates, because I don't see runaway growth. As we mentioned, I think we'll have a slow recovery, a U-shaped recovery, not a V like the market. And that's why I'm not expecting a significant rise in interest rates or inflation. But we are continuing to look for bonds, for our clients moving away from treasuries just because of the lack of value there. And we're looking for opportunities in corporate bonds, looking at investment grade and just below investment grade, looking for some of those fallen angels that were BBB status, but still have pretty good balance sheets, but they were knocked down from BBB to BB. So essentially what we're doing, keeping our maturity of our fixed income short, we're back to a neutral position in equities, and we are quite bullish on precious metals.
Well, Chris, if any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you to discuss your investment outlook or our investment services, what would be the best way to do so?
They can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com, or they can reach me in our office at 888-486-3939.
Chris, always a pleasure to have you on our show for this week's edition of Smart Macro. We look forward to speaking with you again in 2 weeks.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.